Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Today's episode brings us to a university in Indiana, where a young woman is stabbed to death by an unlikely suspect. At 11:38 a.m. on Friday, April 18, 2008, freshman Shasta Myers unlocked the door of her dorm apartment number 405. She and her three roommates, Liette, who went by Lola Martinez, Mandy Hake, and Tanzania Morris, were housed in a four-bedroom apartment on the top floor of Waterfield Residence Halls, which is a dorm complex on Crescent Avenue. This was on the campus of Indiana University, the Purdue University Fort Wayne campus. Nearly 800 students lived in this complex. It's a really interesting setup, Amy. It's set up to be apartment-like instead of actually dorm-like, and it looks that way if you want to take a look at some of the photos. Shasta was juggling her backpack and a bag and was on the phone with her boyfriend chatting away. So she was a little distracted as she entered the apartment, which was silent and seemingly empty. Shasta used her key card to open the door and walked inside and straight into her bedroom. But after just a couple of minutes, she needed to put a bag of chips away in the common kitchen area. So she walked to the kitchen, where there was blood smeared on the walls. There was blood dripped and smeared on the floor as well and the door of the bathroom near the kitchen. Shasta later said her first thoughts were confusion. What was going on? Why was there blood in the kitchen and bathroom? Right next to the kitchen, her roommate Lola's door was cracked open. So Shasta tentatively peered in. Lola lay on the floor, covered in stab wounds and blood. Her hair lay across her face and was wet. She did not respond when Shasta screamed her name and shook her leg. Shasta ran screaming across the hall, yelling, quote, "There's blood everywhere. My roommate's dead." I also want to point out I saw this on surveillance as well. Someone in the apartment across the hall immediately called 911 upon hearing Shasta's screams. Police and paramedics rushed to the dorm with first responders arriving at 11:51 a.m. Squad cars, fire trucks, and ambulances piled up outside the building, students peering out dorm room windows in curiosity. Some later said that it was very scary. First responders found a young woman on the floor in her dorm room in a bloody scene. Unfortunately, Lola Martinez was pronounced dead by paramedics who were unable to save her. The Allen County coroner and prosecutor were also called to the dorm building. The school didn't address the situation right away. This is kind of odd. As will happen in a college setting in cases that we covered, the rumors started to spread throughout the dorm and then the school. But the rumor was that a student had died by suicide. So they had a special event that day, Amy, on campus too. I don't know if you remember, but Chelsea Clinton used to speak at colleges. So Chelsea Clinton was scheduled to speak that day on campus at 12:15. And that was about a half an hour after Lola was found deceased. And she went on as planned. Now, this would be almost understandable if the rumors were correct and, you know, Lola had perhaps died by suicide and there was not a threat to other students, you know, kind of this idea that the show must go on. But that was not the case. And first responders knew immediately that she hadn't died by suicide. She bore multiple stab wounds. It was pretty clear that Lola was murdered. Not until 1:02 that afternoon did a campus-wide notification text go out through the campus alert system that there had been a death on campus. The text notified the students of the murder of a student and was followed by this message. Quote, "We have no suspects at this time, and we urge you to exercise due caution." An email to the same effect was sent at 1:09 p.m. Another at 3 p.m. announced that classes were canceled for the remainder of the day. Just as a side note, there had been no violent crime on the campus of Indiana University Purdue in the school's 40-year history. But now a student was found dead at the hands of a murderer. So who was Lola? As I said, born Liette Martinez on September 22nd, 1985, she changed her name to Lola reportedly because she was sick of people mispronouncing it. She was the only child of Geraldine and Gabriel Martinez. The family lived in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and was very close. Liette, who again simplified her name to Lola, so I'll go with Lola when she went to college, graduated from Mayfield High in 2005. She enrolled at New Mexico State and had studied there for 2 years, but for her junior year, she was enrolled at Indiana University Purdue, which we will just refer to probably as IPFW because it's a lot easier. Lola was able to do this under an exchange program with her school at the time. See, Lola was a graphic designer at New Mexico State University and was continuing on the same path at IPFW. Her parents said that she loved art, so this was the perfect major for her. It allowed her to use her creativity and artistic skills. She also loved to travel and had recently been to Europe and Japan. Lola lived with her three randomly assigned roommates in the Waterfield Camping Housing Complex at IPFW. There's some indication from Lola's MySpace page, which is long gone, but was referenced by some web sleuth users back in 2008, that she missed her family and friends and her dog and that she wanted to return home to New Mexico. So let's talk about how Lola's family was notified about her murder. Geraldine was at home in Las Cruces on April 18th when some state troopers and a chaplain came to her door around 2 p.m., She knew this was a bad sign, but she guessed that something, or she figured that something had happened to her husband at work. Her daughter's safety didn't even occur to her. I just remember them telling me that they found Liette deceased in her room, and after that, that's all I remember, Geraldine said.
So did they tell her at this point that her daughter had been murdered, or did they just say something was wrong?
That's a great question. No, her daughter had not harmed herself. She hadn't been hit by a car or fallen down. They told her that Lola had been murdered and that she had been stabbed to death in her own dorm room. Geraldine called her husband and told him to come home. She did not want to tell him over the phone that Lola was dead, but he insisted that she tell him what this was all about. When she did, he was both shocked and devastated, as you can imagine. Neither Geraldine nor Gabriel knew of anyone who would want to harm their sunny, pious, sweet daughter. But someone had.
So, Megan, what were her injuries like? Is there any indication that this was a crime of passion, or what can we glean from her injuries?
Great question, Amy. Lola had been stabbed numerous times in the neck, shoulders, and the chest. A bloody 8-inch kitchen knife, its handle broken and bent 90 degrees, was found right near her body. Its blade size aligned with the wounds that were found on her. Lola's hair, which lay draped partially across her face, was wet, as I mentioned. She also had burns on her hands, and an empty, heavy pan was on the floor in the kitchen. There was water on the floor that police guessed may have been the cause of the burns and Lola's wet hair. It was a very strange scene.
Were there any signs of sexual assault?
There were not initial signs of sexual assault, no. I know I'm describing them in detail, but no, this did not appear to be a sexually motivated crime. Detective Kenneth Clement of the Fort Wayne Police and Deputy Coroner noted that a T-shirt had been found around Lola's neck, covering several stab wounds to her neck and shoulder. Other than that, her killer didn't try to hide anything. Blood was all over the door and the walls, as we said, smears and handprints in blood, which can become very useful later. Blood was found in the bathroom, spattered on the walls, on shoes, on Lola's floor, on the bed. It looked like a battle had taken place. Observing the scene, though, DA did say that it looked like a personal crime. As we previously said, all afternoon and evening classes were canceled Friday. Students at the school, particularly those in Building H, were unnerved by the killing. Some of them packed up and went home to await the all clear when the murderer was caught. Because it happened in the dorm and on the top floor, everyone realized that the killer was probably someone who had access to the building, possibly a student.
Megan, what about her roommates? I'm assuming they're going to become people of interest since they were the closest to her, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because remember, her roommate Shasta had found her. So the lead detective sat down at the police station with Shasta Myers to interview her about her roommate, Lola Martinez. Of course, investigators were thinking that they would learn from Shasta who exactly Lola hung around with, whether she had a boyfriend, which is, you know, becomes a pivotal question, whether she had enemies and so on. It turns out Lola did have a boyfriend and detectives wrote down his name and contact info with gusto, but Shasta had something else to tell them. She said that she saw Lola around 12:30 a.m. the night before in the apartment kitchen. Shasta then went to bed and heard nothing in the night. The next morning, she left the apartment around 9:30 a.m. to go to class. When she left the apartment, Lola's door was closed, but two people were in the apartment. Her other roommate, Tanzania Morris, and Tanzania's mother, Tina Morris.
Now, is Tanzania, was she good friends with Lola?
You know, I think they became pretty good friends. You know, they didn't know each other initially, but I got the sense that they were friendly. But I think what was surprising to Detective Clement's shock and or surprise, you might say, Shasta told the detective that Tina, Tanzania's mother, had been staying in the dorm with her daughter, like she had been there with her daughter and her roommates for more than 2 weeks.
Where is she from? Was she visiting from far away?
Right. She was visiting. However, her visit was only supposed to be a couple of days, and it seemed to turn into a situation where she wasn't leaving. Shasta said that when she left the apartment that morning, Tina was sitting on the sofa watching TV. So Detective Clement called Tanzania in. She told him the same story with some additional information. She said that her mom had been staying in the dorm with them for 2 weeks, sleeping on the sofa. Her mom, Tina, had participated in a kind of scheduled roommate movie night the night before with Lola and Tanzania. After the movie, Tanzania saw Shasta go to bed and Lola left for her boyfriend's place. Tanzania went to bed in her room and her mom slept on the couch. When Tanzania left the apartment that morning at 10-ish to go to class, Lola was in her room with the door closed and her mom was watching TV. When she got back, Lola was dead and her mom was gone. And her mom was not answering her phone or responding to text messages.
Okay, so what do we know about this woman? First of all, why is she staying in student apartments for 2 weeks? That seems kind of strange, no?
I'm glad you point that out. Could you ever have imagined would your mother have ever stayed? I don't think my mom would have stayed one night in a dorm room with me.
No, it seems bizarre. What's this woman's history? What's her deal? Does she have a job?
Yeah, we're gonna get to all of that, I promise you. All great questions. And at this point, no one knew what happened to Lola Martinez. Shasta and Tanzania didn't come across as very culpable. Shasta was very upset. You know, she was a freshman and she had randomly been assigned to the room in the apartment with these girls who were a little bit older. Detective Clement wondered if this was a possible or potential date rape situation or a random killer loose in the dorms. All options were on the table. But he also began to become concerned because, you know, Lola was dead, but Tina is missing. So had she been abducted? You know, after all, she was the last person in this apartment where a vicious bloody murder had taken place and now she's missing. But there's more information, too. Lola's 2006 Mazda M61 with New Mexico plates was also missing. So police quickly issued an all-points bulletin for the vehicle. They also started looking for, remember, there was a fourth roommate, Mandy Hake. But they quickly learned from the girls that Mandy had a boyfriend back in Michigan, and she often would go to visit him. So she was there visiting that weekend. Police contacted Mandy and checked flight records and confirmed that Mandy had indeed been out of town since Thursday and remained out of town states away where the murder occurred. So she was not involved in any way.
What about Lola's boyfriend? I'm assuming he checks out at some point.
That's a perfect question. So that leaves Lola's boyfriend. Lola wasn't known for being very social. She didn't have a ton of friends at the school. She was doing an exchange program, but she did recently start seeing a boyfriend who she met at her waitressing job. And his name was Brandon, and he was a student at the university as well. The two of them had hit it off and started dating. Lola had started spending some time at Brandon's apartment, where they had more privacy than, you know, they did at her apartment, especially with Tina staying on the couch. So Brandon goes to the top of list, you know, for questioning. Meanwhile, Brandon's just learned the story sweeping across the campus of a student being killed and it involving his new girlfriend.
I'm assuming they weren't together very long at this point?
No, they were not. It was a newer relationship. But he was very upset and he was eager to speak to investigators when they contacted him. He recognized that as one of the last people to see Lola, he was a potential suspect. He was fully cooperative with the police and was quick to let them know that he absolutely did not kill Lola, that he really liked her, and he was also devastated to learn that she had been killed. Brandon told the investigators some other information, though, that might help. Obviously, he's not out as a suspect yet. But he told the investigators that when Lola came over to his place the night before, she was very frustrated and expressed some dissatisfaction with the situation with her roommates. So she had had some type of spat with Tanzania over the movie. While they were watching the film, I guess Tanzania kept asking incessant questions, talking over all the action, and Lola was just getting frustrated.
Yeah, I know nobody who does that during a movie.
I know nobody who would do that. Lola was getting frustrated and finally just told Tanzania to be quiet and watch the movie. So there was a noticeable shift in the mood and like a feeling of tension in the apartment. So Lola, I think that's why she went to Brandon's, because she felt uncomfortable. And Brandon told the investigators that Lola was done with the situation also with Tanzania's mom. So she was venting to him. They had some alone time, and then Lola reportedly stayed at Brandon's until about 1:30 a.m. He then walked her to her car, and she drove off to go back to, you know, her own dorm. According to Brandon, the next thing he knew, she was dead. So Detective Clement sat down with Tanzania again and questioned her about this movie night spat with Lola. She said that she wasn't really offended by Lola snapping at her, and things between the two were fine. But the detective, whose job it was to be perceptive, noticed that Tanzania seemed uncomfortable, and he asked her about her mom and what she was doing in the apartment. So remember, you had asked, like, what is this woman's background and why, you know, is she here?
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Tanzania told the detective that her relationship with her mother was very complicated. She described it as tough. She herself lived with relatives other than her mom, but her mother had just kind of recently parachuted back into her life. Tanzania was okay with her mom coming to stay with her for a night or two, and that was the original plan, as I told you. But Tina just kept on staying. Tanzania said her mom told her that she had a bus ticket out of town and was leaving, but she wasn't clear as to when she was leaving. And after a week, Tanzania knew that her roommates had become a little fed up with the situation. Lola's mom, Geraldine, later said that Lola told her that Tina was staying in the apartment but had not, you know, related any problems. But Shasta confirmed to Detective Clement that Tina was a problem. She was always in the apartment. She and Lola had met up for pizzas to discuss the situation and agreed that they were going to tell Tanzania it was time for her mom to go. They sat down with her and said, you know, what's the plan? It's unclear whether Tina knew the two were trying to oust her. She told them her mom had a bus ticket out of town, but things continued to unwind. So Detective Clement was very curious now, where was Tina Morris? You know, was she in trouble or did she have some information about who could have killed Lola?
Did they think that she was potentially in harm's way?
Yes, they thought they were considering all options. So as I understand it, they thought perhaps she had been kidnapped, someone had harmed her, or she just had information and was scared and on the run. So Tanzania told the detective that her mom might be in Miami. She might have gone there to, you know, visit friends, but she really couldn't be sure because her mom still hadn't called or returned her calls or her texts, and they really weren't very close before that.
So we believe that Tanzania really doesn't know where her mom is.
We believe at this point Tanzania does not know where her mom is. Okay, so, you know, there's also other areas to start looking at. And so the police also began looking at the security systems in the dorm.
Now, Megan, do we think Tanzania really doesn't know where her mom is? Is she maybe covering for her mom?
We think that she does not know where she is. She hasn't heard from her. And, you know, police can get the cell phone evidence on that. Meanwhile, no one in Building H heard or saw anything until Shasta came running out of her apartment screaming for help. The apartment where Lola was killed was on an upper floor, so forced entry from the street level was out of the question, they thought. Students needed a school-issued electronic key fob to get into the building and into the apartment. There were RAs living in the dorm buildings. They were charged with conducting monthly checks of the student apartments, but students were given 24 hours notice of those, so it was easy to hide transgressions or anything else going on. But then just 30 hours into the investigation, Detective Clement pulled the security footage from a dorm hallway camera that provided a view of the apartment's coming and goings. He observed Shasta leave at 9:28 a.m., consistent with what she said. Then he sees Tina, who went out to smoke between 9:20 and 9:30 a.m. and then came back. And that was something the roommate said, that Tina was always there unless she was outside smoking. He further saw Tanzania leave at 10:02 a.m. He saw Tina leave at 10:25 a.m. and she did not return. And then he saw Shasta returning and entering the apartment at 11:38 p.m. when she ran out of the apartment screaming for help.
This definitely gives police a nice timeline of events. They could at least assume the time period in which she was murdered.
I think absolutely. And, you know, further, Mandy wasn't seen on this footage. Brandon wasn't seen and Lola wasn't seen. So, you know, it's confirming the story, but also showing they're not seeing anyone else, strangers going in and out. From the probable cause affidavit, I'll read this directly. Quote, no one else is seen entering or exiting the apartment prior to the arrival of the Fort Wayne police. And no one else is found in the apartment when it was cleared by Fort Wayne police. So when Tina left the apartment at 10:25 a.m., she appeared to be wearing a different shirt than the one she was wearing earlier that day when she went out to smoke. She waited for the elevator for a moment and then took the stairs. What this all meant was that Lola had apparently been alone in the apartment with Tina Morris from about 10:02 a.m. until Tina left at 10:25 a.m., and no one else had entered. Lola's door was closed when Shasta and Tanzania left, but it was open when they got back and Tina Morris was missing. So police were quick then to announce after they saw the surveillance that Tina Morris was a person of interest. Bolos, be on the lookouts, went out for the Mazda as it was suspected that she was possibly in it.
Does Tina have a criminal history?
We'll get to that. Oh, you're trying to get ahead of me. So they're putting out a bolo, but guess what? Tina called them first. She called Detective Clement's cell phone. She told him that she heard they were looking for her. Her daughter had called her repeatedly and told her mom, if you did this, you need to turn yourself in. Tina told Clement that she was in Indianapolis sitting on a park bench. She had Lola's car with her. Clement dispatched some officers from the Indianapolis PD to pick Tina up. She was brought back to Fort Worth for questioning. She spoke with Detective Clement in a custodial interview on Saturday, April 19th. So at this point, the whole investigation had taken less than 36 hours.
It sounds like she was willing to talk to them. Is she giving a confession or what does she have to say?
Good question. And she was willing. She at first told Detective Clement that she had killed Lola in self-defense. She said that Lola had attacked her. She also told her family this story later on. But he didn't buy it. He told Tina basically that it would be better for her in the long run if she admitted what she did. He told her that they had evidence that she was the aggressor in that situation. And eventually, Tina told the, quote, real story. So this is what Tina said. Now, Tina had watched the interaction between Lola and her daughter, Tanzania, during the movie. Remember the movie they watched the night before Lola was killed. She said that she did not like the way Lola spoke to her daughter. She said she wanted to talk to Lola about the issue that night, but remember, as the movie ended, Lola left to go to her boyfriend's. So Tina said that she was basically stewing all night. And that morning, after everyone left for the day, she confronted Lola about how disrespectful Lola was to her daughter. According to Tina, she saw a knife lying on Lola's desk and grabbed it. And Lola tried to grab the knife, but Tina jerked it away and stabbed the young woman. Lola fell back into the bed, and Tina grabbed a pan of boiling water from the stove and threw the water on Lola, then hit her in the face with the pan. The fight continued, and she stabbed Lola again, and Lola fell to the floor unmoving. Tina suffered a cut on her finger from the knife as she was stabbing. She then changed her clothes, grabbed Lola's car keys and wallet, and left, hiding her hand in her hoodie pocket so that she didn't attract any attention to her cut.
So she admitted that it actually was not self-defense, correct?
Yes, it sounds like that.
We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors.
We want to take a moment to tell you a little bit about our friends over at CrimeCon.
What is CrimeCon, you might ask? It's only the greatest convention in the world of true crime, where thousands of people come together to discuss their favorite cases, rub elbows with some of the biggest stars in the world of true crime, and interact with some of their favorite podcasters.
CrimeCon is a great place to meet people just like you who have an interest in true crime, and you get to hang out with some of the biggest names in true crime, people like Nancy Grace, Paul Holes, and Dr. Henry Lee, just to name a few.
It's a 3-day event, and the next one is less than a year away. CrimeCon 2023 will be in Orlando, Florida, at the World Center Marriott, September 22nd to September 24th, 2023. And listeners of Campus Killings can save 10% on your standard badges for CrimeCon 2023 when you use our promo code at checkout when you go to crimecon.com. That promo code is Campus Killings, all one word, no spaces.
Book your trip now before spots sell out. And who knows, maybe we'll see you there in September.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
There was some fallout at the school. Lola's death was termed the only violent crime in the 40-year history of the school. And they were reeling from the violent murder of a student there. From the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, IPFW student Frederick D. Jones was shot at a party in an apartment near the campus April 6th. Police, who made no arrests in Jones' killing, say he was an innocent bystander hit by a stray bullet during an argument at the party. So I said before the school was reeling from the violent death of a student. What I meant was the school was already reeling from the violent death of another student. So this is really, they have two students who've died. Frederick was only 19 when he was killed. His case remains unsolved. His death was not on campus, whereas Lola's was, but it was still very unsettling. In light of the fact that the school had been clueless that Tina was living in the dorms, mooching off her daughter and her roommates for 2 weeks, IPFW officials began a review of the school's safety policies. This from the Campus Safety magazine. Currently, school officials are reviewing the guest policy for the 9-building complex. As it stands, guests of the opposite sex are not allowed to stay overnight, and same-sex guests are only allowed to stay for 72 hours. Tina and Tanzania had clearly ignored this policy altogether, and they weren't the only ones, apparently. At the time of the murder, there were only 21 resident advisors for 9 buildings housing nearly 800 students. It's not a surprise no one in a position of authority had noticed Tina in the building. After the murder, students told the media that the rule prohibiting guests for more than 3 days wasn't enforced and was often ignored. Quote, when I lived there, we'd have random guys walking around probably in their 50s or so, and it took weeks to kick them out, IPFW freshman Tracy Duncan told News Sentinel. Because it's apartment-style living and not really a dorm, it's easier to get away with breaking the rules, another said. I found it slightly disturbing to hear that there were men in their 50s walking around these dorms on a college campus. It doesn't seem like an appropriate place. And get this, there was no dorm monitor at the front entrance to Lola's building. Students needed key cards to get in, but we've seen people circumvent this time and time again by just slipping in after you know, someone who has a key or getting someone to hold the door from them. This from the News Sentinel. Discussing access to the buildings, Director of Student Housing Sarah Garcia said students are issued only one key fob, the electronic device that gets them into their designated buildings and rooms. The key fob cannot be copied, Garcia said. That means that Morris was either using her daughter's key fob or was being let in by others, which students at the scene of Friday's stabbing said is a common occurrence. The Chronicle of Higher Education reported that in the wake of the slaying, quote, administrators plan to discuss adding more resident advisors and residence hall monitors who would sit at the entrance of each building. But as the News Sentinel pointed out, suspected killer Tina Morris' presence violated policies and security measures put into place to protect the 750 students living in the apartment-style dorms at IPFW. But even Chancellor Mike Wortel said, quote, if we had a standard dorm with a person sitting at a desk, they're not going to stop a mother. IPFW was criticized when it emerged that of the 303 security cameras placed throughout the campus, both interior and exterior, 8 were not working on the day of the murder.
Megan, don't you see this? Somehow this is a theme in the cases we discuss. There seems to be always cameras that are not working.
I mean, in so many cases we discuss, policies not enforced. We also see the same thing with the key fob, which is not uncommon on college campuses. Administrators were quick to point out that it was Detective Clement's review of the working security footage outside Lola's apartment that allowed him to actually solve the case. So while they're being criticized for not having the cameras, it was that surveillance that led to a break. And by August, changes had been implemented on the campus. This is from the News Sentinel, which covered the updated policies in depth. Quote, while visitors must still pass through 3 locked doors before reaching a student's bedroom, with 301 cameras recording their movements at all times, students will now have to keep better records of their guests. The rule on same-sex guests still applies. They can stay no more than 72 hours. But students will need to check in guests with resident assistants and get their roommate's permission. We're emphasizing with students that in many ways they have to do their part in making sure we have a safe environment, a spokesman said. Students also will be required to enter and exit through the main doors of the Waterfield complex. Side doors that students formally could open to leave the building are now for emergency use only. The campus-wide email emergency alert system, which notified students a death had occurred on campus, but not until some 90 minutes after Martina's body was found, is being replaced. Okay, so just to break down that quote, just to break that down a little bit, because it was a little bit long. So what's new? What are the takeaways here? Well, what's new is they're going to do stricter monitoring of guests. So, and also those guests have to be checked in with a roommate's permission. And they were going to have more campus police patrols of the student housing area. They were going to have alarms on exterior doors of buildings, except the main doors. They were going to offer resident assistant crisis training, or I should say require it. They were going to have a new campus-wide email alert system and plans to stage a mock incident for campus-wide crisis training. Okay, so that's what's new. Well, what's not? What's the same? 301 cameras recording at all times. The electric key system to enter buildings and apartments. The double cut key needed to enter individual bedrooms within those apartment style dorms. That's, you know, still the same. Partnership with Fort Wayne Department to assist in investigations remain the same. 15-man IPFW Police Department, most retired Fort Wayne officers. So that's what changed and that's what remained the same on campus. What are you wondering now, Amy?
Well, I want to know what happened to Tina. Did she take a plea?
There we go. On April 21st, Tina Morris, age 36, 5'6", 170 pounds, was booked on charges of murder and auto theft. Police were found to have probable cause to hold her without bond. They had 72 hours per Indiana law to charge her or let her go. So on April 24th, the charges were initiated against Tina for murder, felony murder for the murder in the course of a robbery, robbery and auto theft. A new warrant was issued for her arrest, and she was held on $25,000 bond, which she could not post. So she would remain in custody pending a trial if she chose to have one. The same day, the 24th, Lola's funeral took place in Las Cruces. A memorial service at the Fort Wayne campus where she died held the same week, was attended by hundreds of students. The service focused on Lola's creative and spiritual persona and honored her with prayer and student-led speeches regarding their memories of her. Tanzania Morris was in attendance. After Lola's death, in observation of her murder and that of Frederick Jones in the same month, the school took steps to furnish students with outlets to express their grief. From the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, quote, "In memory of both students, four walls, which will serve as giant postcards, are being constructed around campus where individuals will be able to share thoughts and memories about Liette Martinez and Jones. Those blue and white postcards will then be given to the families. Individual bricks are also being laid near the Walb Student Union with their names inscribed, and a tree is being planted by Jones' friends in the student housing complex."
Okay, still want to know what happened to Tina.
Yes, I know, but things are happening. You know, we're doing a timeline here, but all right, since you want to know about Tina. In June, Tina's public defender filed a motion indicating that they intended to use the insanity defense. Bet you didn't see that coming.
No, because the fact that she fled, it already shows that she knows what she did was wrong.
Good call. The court ordered psychiatric examinations of the defendant to establish whether she was fit to stand trial, scheduled for September. After several meetings with Tina, the psychiatric doctor issued a finding that Tina was not incompetent, meaning that the insanity defense would almost certainly fail, Tina's attorney advised her. This was because her actions after the murder were calculated and deliberate, Amy, as you pointed out about the car. Remember, she changed her clothes. She stole Lola's car and credit cards, by the way, too, and used them. She was seen on that surveillance camera hiding her hand. She dashed down the stairs instead of waiting for the elevator. So Tina's father, Henry Brewer, advised her against taking a plea agreement. That was because he was under the impression, because Tina had told him this, that she acted in self-defense. But she hadn't, and they weren't really going to be able to use that either. And the police and prosecutors, you know, knew that this was not a self-defense case. Tina was facing 88 years if convicted of all four charges. So what do you think she's going to do, Amy? I always love this. Go to trial or take a plea?
I think it would be smarter of her to take a plea. I don't think she has a fighting chance at trial.
That is exactly what she decided to do. On August 20th, Tina Morris pleaded guilty to murder. The other three charges of felony murder, robbery, and auto theft were dismissed. On September 19th, the sentencing hearing in Allen County Superior Court was attended by Lola's parents, Gabriel and Geraldine Martinez. Lola's family also did not want a trial. Her parents were devastated at the unthinkable murder of their only child. They did not want to rehash it all at a public trial. Instead, they were satisfied with the plea deal. This from the Journal Gazette. Quote, "On Friday morning, Martinez's family and friends, wearing pink ribbons adorned with butterfly pins in honor of Liette, gathered in an Allen Superior Courtroom to address Morris. A video montage of Lola's life prepared by her mother was shown, accompanied by the song Over the Rainbow. It was 3 days before what would have been Lola's 23rd birthday. Gabriel addressed Tina directly, telling her that they had done everything for their daughter and that their world revolved around her. They were excited for her to graduate, to marry, to have grandchildren. Quote, "All we did, everything we did was to open doors for her to succeed in life. We were so proud. We're still proud." He went on, "We will try hard and we will pray hard, but forgiveness right now is not in my heart. Maybe in the future." Sadly, he covered his face as he wept, walking back to his seat. Frank Estrada, Liette Martinez's grandfather, said, quote, "There are no words that have been invented to address the loss of a loved one. You committed an awful act and you must live with it for the rest of your life."
Did she show any remorse, Tina?
You asked if she, you know, showed any remorse. I understand, and we're going to get there. Just a little bit more about Lola's family, though, and that this aspect of forgiveness, because Lola's family did try to forgive Tina. They didn't hold a grudge against her family. At the sentencing, the Martinez's hugged some of Tina's family, sharing in their anguish. Quote, "This is a terrible thing that we all have to go through," Rebecca Estrada, Liette Martinez's grandmother, said, referring to both families. And Geraldine had privately met with Tanzania to let her know that she did not hold her responsible for Lola's death. But Geraldine said she was still working on forgiving Tina. In her turn to address Tina before the sentencing, she said, "We miss her voice. We miss her hugs. Tina, we do not hate you, but we ask you why. We cannot forgive you for the pain you have caused our family and your daughter, Tanzania. We miss her voice. We miss her hugs. Tina, we do not hate you, but we ask you why. We cannot forgive you for the pain you have caused our family and your daughter, Tanzania." Now, it's understandable that Geraldine was unable to forgive. She and her husband, Lola's father, had to drive to IPFW, by the way, and clean out Lola's room and collect their deceased daughter's things. Not something any parent should have to do. The News Sentinel reported from the courtroom. You asked about Tina, right, Amy? So this was what they said. Tina Morris, who wept and avoided eye contact with the Martinez family throughout the sentencing, had no answer and only a brief apology. Morris's family also apologized, insisting she was not violent and asking Judge Fran Gull for mercy. She has three kids and they're trying to make it, Angela Gordon, Morris's cousin, told Gull. Show all the mercy in your heart. But prosecutor Steve Godfrey pointed out Tina's violent criminal history, which we will get into. He termed the murder senseless. He told the court that word is often thrown around too much, but here it really applies. When it was time to pronounce sentence, Judge Fran Gull said to Tina, quote, "How horrible that after you did all of that, you threw scalding water on this young lady. That just defies humanity. Your conduct has destroyed two families, the family of the victim and your own. From all accounts, Liette Martinez was bright, energetic, and full of potential. You took all that away." Gull then sentenced Tina to 60 years in prison, the maximum the plea allowed for. Tina had a criminal record, and there was no way she was going to avoid this harsh sentence for the senseless and brutal stabbing, beating, and burning of a demure, religious, and hardworking college student. Tina wiped away tears as her fate was sealed, but she gave only a brief, whispered, tearful apology in court and failed to express real remorse.
When someone takes a plea, why is there a sentence? Isn't there usually, like, part of the plea deal is the sentence? How come she was sentenced after... Do you see what I'm saying?
We don't know that the 60 years wasn't part of the plea deal. It might have been. Do you know, okay. Like they could have agreed on that already, or they could have agreed on sometimes they can also agree to leave it to a judge's discretion in a certain range. But
gotcha.
You know, with her criminal history and it's possible mm-hmm. there are sentencing guidelines too. You know, there was not always much room for the plea deal.
And now a brief word from our sponsors.
So let's talk just a little bit about Tina's record, because we suspect that if Tanzania had been honest with her roommates about her mother's criminal history, they would not have been comfortable with her staying in the apartment. This all comes from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Quote, "The woman accused of killing IPFW student Liette Martinez in her dorm had run-ins with local police and was convicted of a felony in Tennessee. She had also been convicted of setting fires in an apartment complex. Allegations in Fort Wayne Police Department also report her accused of molesting a relative, stealing from a relative, and refusing to give her ex-husband access to his children. But she was never charged with crimes in those instances." Do you feel like this is a common theme, too, in some of these cases of, you know, these crimes, serious crimes, but maybe they're not, you know, she's not being charged or punished. And that's the one of the problems.
Yeah, but we also have a legal system where there has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So
absolutely. One report filed in May 1998 briefly details Morris's arrest for starting fires at apartments at 2707 Stardale Drive. She was eventually convicted of misdemeanor criminal recklessness, according to court records. 8 years later, a high school junior told police Morris molested or tried to molest him twice. This was according to a police report. And so these are just the details. In 2000, Morris's roommate called police because she'd become violent during an argument. When the police arrived, they found a shattered glass coffee table, broken bar stools, and a smashed cordless phone. Morris wasn't there, though, and no arrest was made. In 2005, her ex-husband called the police complaining he could not get his children back after letting them stay with Morris while he was in jail. The responding officer could not find the address, according to a police report. In 2007, a woman accused her of stealing checks and a credit card. The woman also said that her home had been set on fire a month earlier, and she suspected Morris, who was not charged or arrested. According to Tennessee records, Morris was convicted of theft of $500 to $1,000 there and sentenced to probation in the mid-1990s. The Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette reported that after the 1998 misdemeanor conviction for criminal recklessness, Tina was given a suspended 180-day jail sentence contingent on receiving a complete psychological assessment and counseling. Given how many dangerous, aggressive, and criminal behaviors she engaged in since that time, it doesn't really seem that counseling stuck. And it was really just, I think, a matter of time before she irrevocably harmed someone. And that time was apparently on April 18th, 2008, when she murdered Lola Martinez over a perceived slight. Tina is currently incarcerated at the Rockville Correctional Facility in Rockville, Indiana. Geraldine Martinez told the Sun News of IPFW, quote, "Lola felt safe there. Her father and I talked to her every day. She always put others before herself. She was our baby, our only child. She was a good girl and loved life." Most parents have to live with the logical concerns that arise when their, you know, children go off to college, leaving the protective shelter of the home. There's typical challenges that we probably experienced and witnessed, you and I, hazing, excessive drinking, sexual assaults, theft, and really so on. But I don't think anyone could have expected that Lola Martinez, a rule follower and a risk-averse young woman, would be stabbed to death by the adult parent of a roommate. I guess, you know, maybe the takeaway here is that all of this could have been avoided if the school had enforced its policies better. And, you know, if Tanzania's roommates, none of the roommates, any blame to them, but if they had possibly filed complaints with an RA, if the RAs had been more present, in the end, there are lots of things we know the school could do, and we hope that they're doing them. But, of course, the blame really lies with Tina Morris, whose selfishness and pride led her to lash out against an innocent bystander. And the result, unfortunately, was a tragedy. We hope with the changing policies and the punishment of Tina Morris that the families have found some measure of justice and healing. Thank you, everyone, for listening today, and we hope you'll join us next time on Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg, with research and writing by Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook by searching for Campus Killings Podcast. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.